I will shatter the hardness into a million pieces, and from the remains, nurse back to life the flowers that once secretly bloomed within, the ones you left parched and thirsty, the ones you neglected for so long. While you let them die, did you remember that half of you is made up of your tender mother?
This is the Beware Hal
Show.
Mystic philosophy made practical. I'm Bob, speaking weekly with Scott and Ryan. We're three conscious creatives and formerly closeted mystics trying to unpack the inaccessible. According to the mystics, the truth cannot be spoken, but we'll try to talk about it anyway.
Hello, I'm Bob, and this is the Beware Hal Show, speaking with Scott and Ryan. Today is Sunday, July 5th, and we have our first guest on the Beware Hal Show. No pressure for Sara Bawani. Sara Bawani is a social worker. She has received her master's in clinical social work at UT. She has bachelor's degrees in biology and Islamic studies. She's currently a full-time social worker with FACE, which stands for Facing Abuse in Community Environments. And she's also a published author who has released Wholehearted, which is a book of poetry on being, brokenness, facades. From the description, Wholehearted seeks to encompass as many stories as possible, touching on several topics, namely spirituality, feminism, colorism, domestic violence, intersectionality, mental health, and more. It aims to depict that anyone with the darkest past and pitfalls can still save themselves from drowning in the difficulties that not only plague our world, but also plague our hearts. It's a fantastic piece of work, and I cannot wait to jump in. I'm sure, hopefully, get some excerpts. I got some faves, and so excited to talk to you about all the above. So thanks for joining, Sara.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're so glad to have you. Before we jump into kind of FACE and social work and then Wholehearted and poetry, tell us about yourself, about your background.
I think you covered it pretty well. I am a social worker by profession. Counseling and mental health and advocacy and social justice is kind of all of my passions, and I found all of that in social work. Besides that, I identify as a Pakistani American Muslim woman, also a rabbit mom, and that's about it. Many identities. Rabbit mom is quite important. I like to throw that one out there. I have two pet rabbits, and they're joyful for sure.
How many rabbits?
Two.
Nice.
Yeah, my husband and I just moved in together, and so he's getting used to them, and so it's really funny to see him acquaint to them, where I was like, I did this 6 years ago.
Do you let them kind of run around the house?
We do, yeah. I'm not a fan of letting them be cooped up, and so they
totally,
yeah, they it's a small place, so it's easy to watch them. So it's been nice. Aside from that, as you said I also write. I'm a freelance editor, a poet, a published author, sometimes a speaker, but not by choice often. And I'm just someone who is really just looking to and working right now on just finding my place in the world and trying to figure out how I can use myself, my skills, et cetera, to help as many people as possible and educate as many people as possible on the things that I know and am familiar with.
You're on a great start so far. You're off and running. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, tell us a bit about, if you don't mind, going a bit further in your experience as a Pakistani American. I mean, I should also say we worked together. I filmed your interview. It was actually 4 years ago. Back when you were a student at UT, yes, 2015 or 2016. And I was referred to, we have to mention this, by the late, great Sheikh Umar, Muhammad Umar Ismail, who passed last year. terrible loss for the community because he was so great. He was such an interfaith activist and passionate teacher, and you knew him a lot better than I did, but he so inspired me from an interfaith, you know, unity that was his message. He would show up at, like, I think when there was Jewish, the synagogue victimhood happened in America. He was like the imam at the Jewish vigil. You know, he was like kind of that guy. He was at the trans march, you know, of saying, yeah, like, we're all in this together. I mean, he was just such a beautiful figure. So, you know,
at the LGBTQ rally.
Yes, exactly.
I think against the vigil for the Orlando victims. I remember that was really amazing to me to see him being the forefront of the Muslim community coming together for that. So that was incredible.
Yes, seriously. He really inspired me. And so peace to his memory and his family. But he referred me to you. He was my second interview on that project of 9 of you guys, I think is what it was. And he said, you should interview the student. She's really great. And that the part that you shared about wearing a hijab was so awesome.
I don't even remember it. That's what's so funny.
Well, basically what you said was, it's about, I'll paraphrase you. It was about how in America, everything with a woman, femininity is all about appearance and hair and makeup and, you know, and what's nice about the hijab is it's actually empowering. You know, you think it's limiting or subjectifying or whatever, but that's only one perspective. The other perspective is that now my intellect is my identity. It doesn't have to do with what I look like. And I have shared that with so many people.
It was deep. I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was great. It was really good. I think it's probably like you have like a boilerplate of just like depths that you just go to, that you just play the tapes of, and that was that one. But you know,
well, I'm glad it's been timeless since then.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you said you grew up in the Dallas area in Texas, which actually there is from what I understand, there's a pretty decent Middle Eastern community in Dallas. What was that like?
So I actually didn't grow up in Dallas per se, and I'm also not Middle Eastern. So
we're getting educated today.
Yeah. So I actually grew up in several different states. I was born in Minnesota. I lived in Ohio and then California and then Texas and then Florida and back to Texas. And within Texas have moved a couple different places since about 2008. And it's just been a really interesting time for me, because I think I'd say my experience as a Muslim American is a little bit unique because I didn't really grow up around like our people very much. We were always a little bit far off from the community, and that impacted the way, not necessarily my identity, but I think there was a lot of, in some ways it almost empowered me to be so firm in my identity because I was always the only one. I very obviously could not blend in. I didn't look like anyone. I didn't talk like anyone. I was also smarter than everyone and better at math, or all the stereotypes. But as a Pakistani American, and that would be South Asian, we don't identify as Middle Eastern. Middle Eastern would usually be, Iraq, Saudi Arabia,
Palestine.
And so, yeah, I think it was very unique because I grew up primarily around white Americans and I identified as American, but like, I think I also didn't really, I also had this sense of like, I don't actually really fit in, or I don't really belong the way I think I would like to, or maybe need to. But because I had a lot to offer to the people around me, my experience was generally really good, which I know is also very unique because when I see the kind of places I grew up in and I see their political views now, and it's quite disappointing. And I just wonder like, wow, this was in them the whole time. They mooched off my math homework and they still grew up to hate me. And it's just like, wow, that sucks. So yeah, it's Dallas itself has grown a lot in terms of its Muslim community. It's kind of called, it's actually nicknamed like the Mecca of America because of how many Muslims have moved there the last several years. And the reason for that being is that there are several really top-notch Islamic scholars and programs that have been developed there. It started with actually, I don't want to say what it started with because we don't talk about that organization anymore. Spiritual abuse, things like that. But it started with several different schools and programs and seminaries that kind of came into fruition there. And before you know it, there's like this migration from different parts of the US to Dallas. And I used to be really, really involved in the Dallas Muslim community. And to some degree, I still was, but I guess, and I still am, but in a very, very different capacity than what it's been before. I think I was previously really involved in just trying to understand the faith and be really, really entrenched in the faith community. And now I think I'm a little bit on the fringe, not because I don't identify with the faith or anything, but because my work is so different and I am so different. And to be quite honest, I have like a low tolerance for a lot of the community politics that happen within any community. And in just the work I do, which is constantly exhausting, constantly like going here and there and here and there to speak or to, you know, do some editing work or to perform a poem or whatever it is that I need to do. The way that I am involved in the Muslim community now has changed a lot. But I think not necessarily in a negative way at all. It's still very positive.
I think you're doing brilliant work, and don't doubt yourself or don't, you know, because it's different. I think it's extremely important. And I think that makes a great segue for what it is. Let's jump into FACE and your work with Ali.
Sure. So FACE is it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We were founded in May 2017. And Alia Salem, my coworker, my boss, my friend, she's incredible. She's a local Dallas Muslim activist, and she is just amazing. I hope you guys interview her after this, because you definitely will want to hear from her. But she founded FACE because she noticed a really big gap in ethical accountability, not just for the Muslim community's religious leaders, but really for all religious and community leaders who abuse their positions of power specifically to inflict abuse on congregants, on women, on children, etc. And so that's the basis of why we were founded. What we're most known for are the misconduct reports we've published once we've compiled our findings on a case that we've gotten. So for example, the very first case that we received, which was how FACE was founded, was the Jane Doe 1 versus Zia Sheikh. And that's like the actual court case name, but we would just call it the Zia Sheikh case. And he was a religious leader at the Islamic Center of Irving who had taken advantage of a pastoral counseling relationship he had with her, had a sexual relationship with her, and then left her after 5 years of counseling her. And she was so devastated, and there were so many things that she was going through. And so her mom reached out to Alia and was like, what do I do? Like, what can we do about this? And Alia was like, there is literally nothing out there, and we're going to create something. So that's how it was founded. And that was the first.
Wow.
Yeah. And since then, so we actually only have two staff members, myself and Alia. And between us, we've gotten 74 cases or like reports from the US and Canada and even sometimes around the world. And right now, I believe we have 22 to 25 open cases. And so far, we've only published two reports. And these reports often take months, sometimes years. There's been several that we've been working on for a very long time. But we are starting to see the importance of the work we're doing just because of how many people are finding out about it and reporting to it and asking for help. And it's one of those things where, like, you know, it's a problem, but you don't realize how big of a problem it is until you actually start to really dig deep. And that's definitely how we felt, is like, we always feel like we're drowning. I think just this past week I did 4 intakes, and I had granted been off for a week. And I think we got those allegation reports then, but it was just exhausting. And we were like, we can't do all this by ourselves. There's too much. And even though the Muslim community in the US makes up maybe 2 to 3% of the general population, it really just makes me think, like, if this is how many cases we have in our community, like, I just wonder what other religious communities must be going through. Because of course, it doesn't matter the faith or the religion. Abuse exists across all spectrums, across all socioeconomic statuses, across all ethnicities and faiths. And we've even collaborated often with other faith groups who are undergoing similar discussions or just trying to, you know, develop their own processes for dealing with this. I think the Buddhist community, and then there was, I don't think we ever got in contact with them, but there's a big website on the Catholic community, kind of like a database on abusive priests, which is pretty much what we're trying to do for the Muslim community. So yeah, it's a lot of really interesting work. It's not something I ever thought I'd be doing. When I got into social work, I got into it really for two reasons. It's because my passions were domestic violence and mental health counseling. And I found those and I was able to do those, but like kind of combining all of them, it took me in this very new direction that I'd never really anticipated or even thought about or really even existed at the time. So I still counsel on the side. I started off my career by counseling for 2 years at a nonprofit in Fort Worth. And I still do that once a week, which I think is really good. It kind of helps keep those skills sharp, because as a social worker, you have generally two tracks. It's like the macro track and the micro. And the micro would be the counseling aspect, and the macro was kind of everything else. We do like policy work and, you know, curriculum development or, you know, manual development. And I think I've like just drafted our case management manual, and that was like a cool project I got to do. And just it's a unique, wonderful opportunity, because even though my role there is a case manager, I'm also helping a lot of the projects and things kick off that we've had in mind or Alia has had in mind, but I've finally gotten to actually put together. So yeah, it's a really wonderful organization. It's a great opportunity. I'm really thankful for it. And I'm really thankful for the work it does, because I know even though we're not perfect in the sense of like there's not enough of us to go around, just to know that there is someone there who not just understands this, but is working to do something about this is, I think, a big relief for a lot of the community.
It's incredibly important work. It's really, it's so encouraging to hear about organizations like FACE that are empowering victims. Because like you said, it is not just the Muslim community. It's all religious communities and institutions even. We had a conversation, me and the guys recently, about how, you know, I think for a lot of, kind of in the mystic or like kind of Eastern appreciators of the West, kind of the white people that read Buddhist books and things like that, we tend to kind of be dismissive of like Christianity because that was our upbringing. And we're like, oh, the Catholic abuse scandals and all that. And like, we tend to kind of, like have this more affection for Buddhism and Hinduism and kind of, you know, see it without a critical eye. And a few years into reading Hindu texts for me, a few years ago, that actually happened. The temple was called Barsana Dham in Dripping Springs. And there was an allegation of two young women were, you know, sexually assaulted by the head guru of the temple. And I was probably on my third Yogananda book. I was like, this stuff is incredible. And, you know, and it was very useful, you know, despite being a terrible thing, obviously, that happened. It was useful for my understanding to kind of contextualize the fact that, look, every path has saints and every path has sinners. Every, you know, every religious institution has, I think, really very, very powerful messengers and teachers and the barbarians, you know, and the lowest of us, even in the one that I was so entranced by at the moment. So, you know, it's an exhaustive issue that you guys will never run out of, unfortunately, I don't think.
Unfortunately, yeah. And sometimes it can be both, like the person who is the figurehead, who's inspiring the most people, who's done the most good work, and also have a lot of skeletons in their closet. And not just on a personal level, but something that affects the community at large and actually makes it dangerous for him to be in that position of power. And so, you know, the reason this work is so important is because it's not just about what you do behind closed doors. Like, for example, there's this Islamic principle of private sin. And like the idea is that you don't expose the private sins of your brothers and sisters. But that's a completely different story from when the sin you're committing is causing harm to someone else. That's a completely different concept and a completely different part of the faith. And that's what we're looking to do. Like, you know, drinking alcohol is forbidden in Islam. And if you're a big imam or sheikh and you drink alcohol every night, like, we don't really care. Like, you probably shouldn't be an imam or a sheikh, but like, that's not what we're here for. We're here for you specifically using your position to exploit and abuse other people. And that's the problem, is when people who are narcissists or otherwise or something get in those positions of power and then use those to harm other people. And that's what's completely unacceptable. And I think there's been like this movement, especially since Me Too came up, to really like hold our communities accountable. And it's unfortunate because I think so many people are still a little bit in the dark or very much in denial, which is understandable with something so traumatic and horrible, is that if we don't have our leaders and if we don't have our religious leaders, then what do we have? Like, what foundation do we have? And I think the point that that brings you back to is like, well, you have God and then you have yourself. And sometimes that should really be all you need. Because to put people on pedestals and to rely on your, to use your faith to rely on other people, it doesn't work. And this, when these things get exposed, it just proves again, it doesn't work. And it was never really, your faith was never meant to be reliant on somebody else. And if it was, then it probably wasn't as strong to begin with. And that's a hard thing to say or admit, but in a culture where I think we're taught to worship cult personalities and celebrities and influencers, and I hate that word, but where there's people that are very visibly and clearly on the top, and we've made them that way. It's not just because they got there or they had the money or they had the time or the talent. It's also because we, who are not up there, let them be there and actually push them up there because we don't feel we're worthy enough to answer to ourselves. And so other people have to answer for us or speak for us. And so I think that can be very damaging to faith and just to a sense of self. And I've seen in the work that I do, people's faith be really, really damaged by this kind of abuse, and not just in like a firsthand trauma victim, but like secondhand victims from in the community who were like, well, this person was everything for us. Brought our community up, and now we're supposed to believe that they were abusers.
It's particularly insidious because not only is it a traumatic experience, but it's almost like a 2.0. It's like that person, you know, is supposedly this big community person, and you know, spirituality is wrapped up in that, and kind of falsified through that transmission of a negative thing. And it's a lot of untangling psychologically that you guys are doing. So hopefully you and Alia are getting the support you need. I'm sure it must be emotionally exhausting to kind of hear successions of these kinds of incidents.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And we always talk about self-care. I'm someone who works like very diligently and on the clock. And she's just like, no, in this work, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And I'm always taking breaks. I actually just got a therapist, so I'm really excited to start again. Nice. Cause I've been to therapy on and off, but I was like, I need like more support, I think, with everything going on in this transition and work and everything. Like, I just need help balancing myself and my time. So, I'm a therapist, but I need therapy, and I think that's completely okay and should be okay.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
You reference your therapy sessions in your poetry, so I'm well aware of your
that relationship. I'm sure you are. Yeah, it's been a while, actually. It's been a while since I've been. I think my last time was late 2017, and I think since last year, it's time. There's never too much therapy you can go to.
Yeah. It's been too long for me as well. I need to go back.
I think this is the perfect time because we don't have to actually drive anywhere. And telehealth, it's way more accessible than I think it used to be. So I'm taking full advantage of that.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I'm all for breaking the stereotype around therapy. I feel everyone should try therapy at some point. It's just an absolutely necessary way to, you know, express yourself and to someone who isn't in your immediate circle, you know, it just feels, it's really great support. And I'm all for it.
It is. And it's also what's so important about it too, is I think it's just a space for you. It's devoted to you and your growth and your time and your trauma and your healing. And I think I was telling someone this the other day who was asking about like finding a couples counselor, and it was like, it's not like we were talking about premarital counseling, and in my experience and like what I've seen or what I've heard other people say, premarital counseling isn't as helpful because it's not as specific. It's like very generic, but at the same time, it's still just a space for you to have those conversations where if you're like wedding planning or just going about your day, you might not actually sit down and have those difficult conversations, you know, with another person that you're going to be married to or with yourself. So I found it to be very powerful. And I think I've had people who, kids, you know, whatever, that come in kind of like reluctantly, don't really want to be there, don't really understand why their parents are making them go. And then they realize like, this is actually like really helpful. Not necessarily because I'm a great counselor, but because like holding space for people is so important and being able to work through everything that it is that not just makes us who we are, but is also getting in the way of who we really are. And therapy is really a great place to work on that.
Yeah, the subconscious reveals it too. I mean, Jung has been someone that I've admired over the years, and his, you know, making the subconscious conscious. I mean, it seems like that's such an intricate part of kind of self-actualization is let's really traverse. Certainly you do that in your work, which we'll get to. I just wanted to mention briefly the face fast, because I did that and that was so fun. I just have one silly thing to share. Yeah, exactly. For context, FACE did a, Sarah recommended that I join the Ally FACE fast for Ramadan, which I probably, Sarah, you should maybe give just a quick like Eli 5 for non-Muslims on Ramadan, and then I'll share my.
Sure. Piece. Yeah. So Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar where everyone is, who is able and will not able, you know, on a socioeconomic level, able to fast for 30 days. And so it's literally 30 straight days, sunrise, not even sunrise, dawn to sunset, of fasting. And it's a little bit deeper than that. People think it's just you're fasting from food or water, but really the idea behind fasting is that if you can restrain yourself from something that's what we call halal, which is like mandated or okay or good for you, then you develop the discipline to also fast, quote unquote, from things that are actually not okay for you, that are haram, that are forbidden. And so it's really like the reason people love it so much is because it's like the biggest, what's the word? It's like a boot camp in some kind of ways. It's like a boot camp where you develop like the strength and you realize like you have the capacity to do so much more than what you do in your everyday life. Like totally. I, for example, this year did it, did a really interesting thing where I would wake up every day at 4:30, which is like a dream that I've always wanted to do, is like wake up at 4:30 and just like do my day. And then sleep like at 9 or 10, and like just stay up after eating that morning meal. And by 8 a.m. I felt like I did so much. Like there's something we said, there's like a barakah or a blessing in your time after that morning prayer. And I felt it. And now it's not Ramadan and I can't even get up at 6. And it's just like, I know I can do it. Like I'm capable of it. And so it's like that for many people. Like many people make different goals that they're wanting to fast from. Like some people every year, like, well, I'm not going to curse during Ramadan because that's something I really struggle with. Some people are like, we're going to read the whole Quran, like cover to cover. And so it's time to not just, and most, a lot of people do. I've done it every year the last couple of years. And it takes a little bit of time, but if you like portion it out well, then you're able to accomplish it, because we believe like the devil is locked up. And that's like also kind of a metaphor for like your personal devils are locked up because the atmosphere is very different. And you're able to do more. And we all see it, that we're able to just do so much more. And God has said that the blessings of Ramadan are multiplied by that of any other time of the year. And only He knows what those blessings are. And so the rest of the people just strive to do as much as possible in whatever way they can. And, you know, this Ramadan was really interesting because generally Muslims will go to the mosque or the masjid every night for the Taraweeh prayers, which is a specific kind of prayers we only do in Ramadan. And everything was closed everywhere. So a lot of people were really panicky and really upset. Like, what is Ramadan going to be like this year? And I think it seemed like a lot of people seemed to really enjoy it and try and make the most of it. But one thing we did at FACE is we did like a little fast for FACE campaign. Where it was like a little interfaith event where we encourage our non-Muslim friends to fast with us, and we encourage people to sponsor them with all proceeds going to FACE. You participate in that. I'd love to hear about what you thought.
It was really cool. I'm so glad you encouraged me to join. My first realization was that Ramadan is hilariously more difficult than Lent,
which is what Christians do, which is like, they're like, well, I'll give up Sour Patch Kids for a month. And it's like, that's not a sacrifice, man. Like,
we all, Sour Patch Kids.
We all like, have, they are good. They are really good.
Lent was a joke, though. It was like kids would be like, for Lent, I'm giving up driving the speed limit. It was just like, no one actually took it
seriously. Yeah. Ramadan is a real asceticism spiritually that I admired. And it was really cool too. We had a Zoom. Is it Iftar? Is that the
Iftar
is the breaking fast. Of the Yeah, we mm-hmm. so I'm sure you, yeah, the Muslim community must have had a ton of Zoom iftars this Ramadan thanks to quarantine. Which is hopefully it was super reflective and it sounds like yours was valuable. My kind of jokey moment was that it was just very physically hard for me. I get hangry, frankly. And so we were watching this documentary series, The Last Dance. If y'all saw that, the Michael Jordan series is about him playing basketball in the 90s. And we were watching that and like 3 to 8 p.m. I mean, I had a headache. Like it was getting to me, and I picked up hamburgers. Mel was like, let's just get some. My wife was like, let's get some. She did it with me actually. Let's get some big good old meal after. And so broke the fast with y'all, kind of, I ate my hamburger while we all shared our experiences with the interfaith allies and you two. And and it was great. And Reverend Michael, by the way, I want to connect with him. I reached out to him. He's like extremely busy right now, I can imagine, but definitely want to pursue a connection with him. And anyway, after all of that, we watched the next episode of The Last Dance, and I felt so good after eating 24 hours later, 18 hours later. Michael Jordan just won his first championship, like kind of like 15, 20 minutes after that, which had been like the whole buildup of the whole series. And so when he wins, he has like the trophy and he's so excited and he's so happy. And my wife was like, hey, look, it's ourselves. And that made me laugh really loud because my cells were as happy as Michael Jordan embracing his trophy. Yes.
It's true.
It was like a bizarre like bath of sensual pleasure that I had never really gotten before. Dry, because it's also dry fast, no water, no food, no nothing. So anyway, it was,
and the first day is always hard.
Showed me just how difficult it was and how much admiration, frankly, I have for the Muslim community globally, because all sects participate, right? It's not it's about a billion people doing this. So it was useful, and I'm glad that it sounded like we brought some awareness to face this cause, and it looked like I got some of those follow-ups that there was some funds that you guys raised from that. So that was super cool.
That's great. Yeah, it was a wonderful event. I'm glad you could join us, and I hope you guys all join next year. I think we're gonna make it a yearly tradition. So
I want to try.
I would. Yeah, I would love to.
Yeah, it'd be really great.
I can do one day. Not 30.
But it's always harder the first day. I think everybody really struggles the first day, and your body is getting adjusted to it. Like, so by day 3 or 4, like most people are good. So
my friend Taza texted me that.
Yeah.
How do you decide between like the dry and non-dry fast? Is that just a personal choice, or is that like a specific?
That's doctrinal.
Yeah, it's always that way.
Wow.
It's a complete fast.
Wow.
And it's also, I mean, Sarah, you can elaborate a bit more too. It's the spiritual component is not only kind of contemplative, but also, or at least how Reverend Mike put it, which I really, really enjoyed, which was he was talking about, you know, look, this is so we gain some perspective on our brothers and sisters that don't have food. I mean, we're trying to identify in a sense with people whose fasts are involuntary and identify with them from a place of brotherhood and empathy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like the way he put that, because I think for many Muslims, and I think for many people of faith, any act of worship is generally explained in a way where it's always about other people. So for example, the way hijab was kind of explained to me growing up was like, oh, to wear, to be modest in front of men. And I grow up and it's literally not that at all. Like, it is, that's like a teeny little, like, not even secondary. It's like the 10th reason on like the hierarchy of reasons why you wear it. And it's the same thing with fasting. I think it was always taught to me that it was like, and to many people, I think growing up, that it's just so you can have empathy for the poor and know what it's like to be hungry. And even though I think that's a very important piece of it and definitely one that's worth mentioning, it's again, just about you and your relationship with God. And then all these other things that come with it will come with it. And if overall it just makes you a better, kinder, empathetic, compassionate person, like that's the whole point. But really at the end of the day, it's about you and your discipline and your faith and your relationship with God and how this is something you do for his sake, no matter how hard it is. And it teaches you so much, and it's overall very beneficial for you as a person. And then of course, for all the charity that you give and for all the people you cook for and for all the calls you make to, you know, Zoom calls, iftars, and those are all the other good things that come from it as well. So I know I'm in my faith journey, like I'm just trying to relearn some of those things of, am I doing this for other people or to protect myself or whatever from other people, or am I doing it because like God has asked us of it, not just because, but there's a very good reason why. And
that's so useful. There's so many layers to it. There are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I've practiced fasting quite a bit, just experimenting with my diet, and it has always been a very spiritual practice for me. Not intentionally. My spiritual practice naturally became a part of it. And it was often just the kind of, the mental discipline of pushing yourself to be able to, discipline yourself and to kind of test yourself in that way. Every time I've done a fast, I think the longest ones I've done is like a 20 or a 48 hour, maybe a little bit more.
Wow.
And, I always feel, first of all, just like, I feel my spiritual practice just feels so concrete afterwards. Mm-hmm. I feel so much more in my body and in tune with myself, and I feel so much more gratitude for food. My relationship with food changes every single time, you know?
Absolutely.
I feel like when it's just in arm's reach and I can just snack whenever I want, my relationship with it is very different. But if I restrain myself for an extended period of time, I just have a lot more gratitude for food. And I tend to want to eat much healthier too when I do that. I'm a big fan.
It brings a consciousness to that process that becomes so unconscious.
Yeah, and that's incredible. Totally. Like we do 18 hours and we're like done. I don't know how 48 hours works, but wow, that's incredible.
I have some friends that are really into it. Some friends that have done some like 9 and 10 day fasts. With water, just water. Okay. But dry fast, I don't have many friends that will coffee. Do much more. I don't have many friends that have done dry fast much longer than 48 hours. It's pretty dangerous to do a dry fast longer than 48 hours because that's like 2 days without water. So I've just had some friends that have been really into it, and it got me interested in it. Also, I've had digestive kind of issues in the past, and so it was a way to explore that. And little did I know like how spiritual of an experience it would be for me. So I'm a big fan of fasting. I love it.
Wonderful. Yeah. See, there's so many side benefits that maybe we don't even think about, and they just kind of end up coming up as a result. And
it's just totally.
The cool thing about spiritual practices.
I was just doing it for the likes. So,
I mean, that's a good side result as
look,
well.
That's what
yeah
initiates it. No, solidarity. with my pal. Let's jump into Wholehearted, shall we?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I talked about it.
Are you writing in the new next one, or you're drowning in work so you can't, or doesn't this work generate that poetic quality that you have?
I wish it did. And I think in an ideal world, it should. I don't know. My relationship with poetry and writing is very strange now. Not that I don't think it's one of those things where you feel like, am I really a poet? Because it feels like it's dead. I don't know where it went. Like, I finished the book. And
you really are. Let me be very direct with you.
but I wrote the book. I published it in September 2018. And then after that, like, I took a really long break, and I'm trying to figure out, like, from like a mental health perspective, why that was. And I think it wasn't on purpose. Like, I did keep writing, but very, very, like, rarely and sporadically. And for me, like, sometimes writing and poetry would feel like a revelation in some really weird way. It was like, it's not me that's coming up with these words. It's like, it's just like, I'm the vessel.
Vesselhood. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's how I view a lot of things. That's how I view my counseling practice, is like, it's not me or my skills or me as a person. It's me holding these stories and these narratives and these spaces for people in order for them to heal. And poetry felt the same way, where it's like, it's not necessarily because, like, I write well or I think this way or whatever. It's like, it just kind of comes to me and I just have to write it down immediately. And that process has been very sporadic lately, and there's like periods here and there where it comes back and I write, and I would love to write another book. I think that's on the table, and I've been brainstorming a little bit about it, and I have maybe like 20 pages done so far, which, like, I wrote since 2018, but definitely not actively working on anything, and which is strange. But I think, you know, if we try too hard with our writing, it's not gonna organically take us where our life is. And so I'm just trying to, as much as, like, I'd love to continue writing and kind of like sit down and force myself to. And I think lately I've been in like this mood where, like, I'm hearing things like happening up here, and I'm like, okay, like, I should pay attention to that, and I should write it down when I get a chance. But, like, I'm just trying to listen. Like, I'm trying to listen to myself and just be in that place of like, okay, as soon as I hear something, like, I'll see if I can come up with anything. But it's hard. Like, it's hard because I'm a really impatient person. I just want to, like, do it. And I just have to really take a step back. And quite honestly, I'm forced to take a step back because there's so much else going on.
You're scaling out a program to the country about how to face abusers in institutional environments.
Casual everyday things.
Yeah. Real light stuff.
Moves and waves.
Yeah, I do so. Just little things here and there.
Yeah, that's a great answer. We talked about that in a creative episode we did where, you know, I think there's a tendency to over intellectualize, and that really ruins the juice of the creative process. Like, it's useful to kind of be sequential with your work, and make it just so it's not just extremely undigestible and like too avant-garde or whatever. But, like, so there is some role that intellectualizing plays and rational mind plays, but it has to come from kind of that spark that you're referring to, right? It has to come from that intuitive quality to really be able to connect with another person emotionally.
Yeah, and sometimes it's dormant, and that's okay. And I think we all have to learn to be okay with that. And
sure.
It's also important to remind ourselves, like, it's not that it's gone. It's not that it was never there in the first place. It's just our life doesn't warrant it.
That is a fear. If it's been dormant for a long time, and then your mind is like, you can never do that again. That was your last one.
Yeah, I've really struggled with that. Like, first and last book. And it's like, I think for the first couple months that I'd published it, people were like, so when's the next one coming out? And I was like, whoa, like, this took me 10 years.
Right.
10 years to put out. Like, the first poem in there is like 2009, 2010.
Wow.
And it was published in 2018. So I was like, I took my time with this one. We're going to still take our time. And I'm definitely taking my time, and not even because I want to.
Yeah, that's
good.
I think that's probably helpful for you. It's like, I took like a 2 or 3 year hiatus basically in writing music. And then I came back and wrote some of my favorite stuff so far. So maybe this whole break hiatus thing has something to it.
Yeah, I almost feel like you come back stronger. Like, I think I had a little writing period from like September to February of this year, and I wrote like 3 or 4 poems, and I feel like they're some of my best works. Like, I think one time I wrote like a really badass poem that I was like, I can never top this. Then I was like, oh, I think I topped it like recently, so I'm glad. Yes.
Nice. You'll then, always since top then, it.
I think we always will. We just have to give ourselves the space to.
Yeah.
Well, despite being indirect and poetic of if you will or existential about yourself as a writer, you are a writer. You moved me several times. I was hanging out with my baby reading your book this morning and cracked open my heart chakra a couple of times. So don't doubt yourself. The main thing are, there's so much about this book that's so great. What I really liked about it was, you know, the really like the rhythm, I think, of the themes that you're exploring. You have depression and anger in there, and it should be, because that's, it's relatable for people and it's cathartic to review that. But also, you know, immediately after that, you're at femininity, masculinity, you're at socioeconomics, and then love and poetic imagery, like the aromatherapy piece, where you're just playing with it. You know, you're traveling through different aspects of the material all the time, and I think that makes it very readable. And like some poetry that kind of gets into the darkness can stay in that too long a little bit for me, and kind of lose the reader. But you're contextualizing all of it in this larger exploration. And I just really enjoyed that. I love that you're kind of going on this journey throughout it. And I'm just a big fan. You just, you really set me off. So cheers.
I'm glad. Did you get to finish it?
I'm 100 pages in and it's 180. Okay. So I'm getting
you're
there.
You're in the third chapter or so.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I'm in undoing. Do you have it? Do you want to read anything from it? Do you have any faves? What's that?
I could go get it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I have one of my faves, but I don't know. This one might be too long to read. But yeah, we'll just have her pick hers because there's a lot. There's so many good ones that I already came across halfway through. So
yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear what else.
The one that kind of got me the most so far was Recipe for Ramadan.
Oh, that's a cute one.
I just love the structure of it. It felt, I don't know. It gave me like a really clear idea of kind of like the mental discipline that I guess you go through, like the order of what you're asking, like the questions you're asking yourself. I don't know. I kind of want to just read the whole thing because if I try to paraphrase it, I'm not going to do it any justice. But anyway, you can, if I'm happy to read it too, but I'll let you pick your faves first.
Yeah, you know, usually I have it here by my nightstand and I have like several bookmarks, but right now my nightstand is a box because I don't have a nightstand. So I have to go get it somewhere else. Yeah, I think this is a cute one because like I was thinking, I was like, I don't really write like the concrete poems or like the acronym poems very much. Like that reminds me of like middle school and high school days, or like I was doing it a lot for fun. And so I was like, this is a cute one. And I'm like, oh, there's actually a lot to it and I didn't remember. So each verse starts with one of the letters of Ramadan. The first one R. Run, you have spent your whole life doing so, from failure, from anything that could jeopardize your false sense of perfection, even from yourself. Ask the difficult questions you were never allowed to. What is your purpose? What were you created for? Is this all there is? Why do we suffer? Meditate on these questions. Let them fill you up and consume every fiber of your being. Bow your head in sujood and seek guidance. Allow your creator to speak to you. Learn from his book. Learn about his book. Read the signs around you. Enjoy the beauty of the little things. Draw your own conclusions. Use the intellect you are blessed with. You are allowed to question. Never let anyone tell you otherwise. Answer, because while you may question, it is also your duty to seek answers. This is why you are here. This is why your existence matters. Nurture the knowledge and let it grow. Cultivate your iman. Allow it to blossom.
Remember that you, young soul, were made for paradise. Find it, seek it, live it.
Beautiful.
I love it.
So nice.
It just, it struck me as such a beautiful like roadmap for spiritual practice, just like a mental roadmap. I love that structure.
Thank you. I think I should like utilize that more in my life like nowadays, because I think, I don't know, so it's really interesting when you go back and revisit poems from like years and years ago and you're just like, wow, like changed so much, but like not necessarily in a way that is as productive. And this seems a lot more productive than I think things are now sometimes. So it's cool to be able to go back to be.
Yeah.
Sure.
I was curious, what the word iman, I-M-A-N, I was curious what that was.
So iman, the easy definition is like faith. Let me see if I can go back and find the context of it.
Yeah, it's nurture the knowledge and let it grow. Cultivate your iman, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so iman would be like the literal definition is faith. But it really just means like your belief. Another word we use is like taqwa, which means like God consciousness. And some people think of taqwa as like fear of God, but it's really just like a consciousness of God. And so it's a little bit connected to iman. Mm-hmm. Where there's three levels of faith. There's Islam, which is more of like the superficial level of belief, like the ritualistic practice. And iman is like a step higher. And then ihsan literally means like the best. And so iman falls in that category as well, but also just means like your consciousness and your faith. I could awesome. Be wrong, so if I'm wrong, but,
don't no, that's that. Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you.
Sure.
One thing we had talked about, we have a few more faves if you would keep reading too. But one thing we talked about was how we all have we're all big fans of Sufism and Sufi poetry, and you know. Rumi was the most read author in America the last few years or something. You know, he sold a lot of books, this 12th century Persian, you know, in America in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's because he's electric and Hafiz and these guys are really, you know, transcending faith systems. They're transcending culture. They're really just speaking so purely from the heart. And I guess the question just is, you know, do you have any relationship with them as a Muslim woman who writes poetry? How do you think of the Sufis, or give us the thoughts on that?
So Sufism is something like I've kind of like very briefly explored, but not to the level where I feel like I'm very well versed in it. I took a class on it, which I thought was really cool and different because I grew up in a very traditional mainstream community. And when I went to UT and majored in Islamic studies, I was like, wow, there's all the other stuff out there that I had no idea about. And Sufism was one of them. So yeah, I definitely...
Did you take Dr. Heider's class, by the way? That's what I took.
yeah, it was great. And it's so sad because I think I would have benefited much more from the major if I was in there now as opposed to back then. I think back then I just thought I'd be learning like my traditional Sunday school Islam, and like it's not that I didn't appreciate it at all, but like it's more like I don't think I was mentally ready for it. And I think I learned a lot, and I think it had me really question a lot of like what I grew up thinking was right, when it was like, no, there's so much more to faith and to God and to Islam than anything I'd ever known. But I think like I wasn't necessarily like ready to consume it the way I might be now. So I kind of wish I could go back and take them again. But actually, with Rumi and Hafiz and some of the Sufi poets, I think the reason I haven't really like grasped them the way I really wanted to is especially with that recent knowledge that when Rumi and Hafiz and all those Sufi poets were translated into English, they erased all of the references to God and really diluted it to fit better to the Western tongue, to be quite frank. And I think there's been a lot of dialogue recently in the last couple of months. I think it started in like March or February or something about, and I have to go back and look at it because I don't quite remember all of it, but the one who was tasked with transforming the poems to English says that he had a dream about it, and then he erased all the references to God, and people reduce it down to like love poetry when it's so much more than that. And so I think because I've only ever read that diluted translated version, I've always felt like I can't really appreciate it for what it is. And I don't understand Persian or you know, Farsi or what it's written in. So it's something I'd like to explore more. And I think just knowing what it's been unfortunately reduced to now, I feel this compelling, like even if I may not understand it, I hope that other people who do read the language or speak the language or like can retranslate it into what it's like, its glory really truly was.
Hear.
Something that really haunted me recently. I was just like, wow, like, I mean, I knew like when I read it, it didn't sound what I would think it would sound like, but I didn't realize how much it had been changed from what the original language was. And English is a language that has many words, but it'll never be able to capture like the Farsi or the Arabic. Like translations are so hard. And I think if they're not done very carefully and eloquently and ethically, there's so much that can be lost. And with Rumi and Hafiz, there is so much that's been lost.
Right, right. And especially by a mystic. You know, the translator ought to be someone that is in the tradition and can navigate those ideas. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and that happens again to all the religions, the mindful community. We've talked about that too, where there's kind of the secularization of Buddhism and how that can be useful in some ways and in order to kind of get the message out with a bigger megaphone, but also like, hopefully what that does in some areas too is like initiate or encourage a more introspective, fuller investigation, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other thing that some people who are against that idea for good reason are worried about is again, just like diluting the principles or the ideas. Like there's this concept of like, quote unquote, the modern Muslim or like a moderate Muslim. And most people really hate that term because it's just like, then you're implying that anyone who's not moderate is extreme, right? And so it's like that's what happens when faith is taken and made comfortable to people who may not be ready to accept the full aspects of it, like again, which is fine because everyone is in a different stage of it, but then you can go into the phase of it just you changing it instead of it changing you just to fit who you are. And that can be useful for some people, but I think overall, especially when you take a religion as Islam, who's been called extreme and is in the spotlight for, you know, extremism for whatever reason, it can be sometimes damaging. I don't know if Buddhism has had to have that spotlight put on it, but I hope not, because it's hard to navigate when that's the case.
Well, you touch on some of that, some of these ideas in your poems, particularly around kind of like there's one of the shorter poems about like being considered exotic. You know, or kind of the Orientalist view. In making the Palestine film, the main person that I walked away with so much respect for was Edward Said, who just blew me away. I mean, he was such a stunning writer and thinker, and the author of Orientalism and, you know, kind of critical eye against the critical eye, really, of saying, hey, you know, white European and American scholars that, you know, view, and actually artists and painters and novelists. It was like just the whole ideological spectrum of the Western world that would view, you know, Asian and Arab cultures through this lens, and him just breaking us out of that. And, you know, the reductivist tendency to kind of fit it into this tiny little box. And, I dedicated the film to him because I was just, more people need to know about him and the work that he did. So, anytime I see that trend now, and I've, you know, a few of your poems, it just, that stuff needs to get out there. I mean, that material, those ideas need to be contemplated, you know, contemplated by America.
Oh yeah, definitely. I agree.
Did you find that one that he referenced? That it'd be cool to hear it.
It's early.
I did. The one about the exoticness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow I've been able to find them really easily today. It's a short one. It's called Fetish. And it goes, your inability to acknowledge entire civilizations and experiences beyond your white picket fence does not make us exotic. And I think that was really like a jab at the people around me in the way that I grew up. And I'm trying to remember like the specific references or the things I was told, but it's like,
people being surprised that my hair was actually hair or like nice, or people being surprised that I was smart even though I wasn't something else, or like just this constant like you're the exception and you're also like good for this but not for much else. And I think I experienced that in a very different way, whereas like I know a lot of people around me were very like fetishized, or like, you know, they were liked by a specific group of people but only because of what they looked like but not actually because of who they are,
or like tokenizing that. Also like,
yeah, very much tokenized. And it's just it's just a really uncomfortable feeling when you understand what it is. And I think like in workplaces and schools and kind of every experience like I've had, like there's always been a little bit of that. And for me, a lot of it was because of like me intellectually as opposed to me how I looked. But there was still this constant idea of like, you're different. And we're going to cherry pick like which things of your differenceness we're going to take or use, and what we're going to discard or what is not important to us. And it's like we have to understand when we approach like the Eastern faiths and texts and religious ideas that like these are all whole people and they're all, you know, people with a very rich culture and tradition and history, and to reduce them down to like a couple of things that we like or things that we can benefit from, is damaging and dangerous, not just to them, but of our ability to process those civilizations as a whole and be able to see them for what they are and to really appreciate them for what they are. That was where that poem came from, I think, or maybe that's how I'm just processing it right now.
Yeah, no, totally. Avoiding caricaturization, right? Also, I took a class in film called Latino Images in Film, and it was just about, like, I mean, and this happens with every marginalized community, in especially in American Hollywood cinema history. The lazy Mexican was like a trope in those old, it would be like the two white leads are walking by and there's like a guy in a sombrero sleeping on the side of the thing. And that scene exists in so many different movies. And like anyone that's actually worked with Mexicans or Mexican Americans knows that they're the hardest working people. Like, it is literally the opposite of those kinds of images. But our media, and there's also a great film actually about Arabs in American cinema called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L documentary. And it's about caricaturization of Arabs in film and how, you know, the association with terrorists and violence, and it's just, and media obviously also, but I think the way out of that is the work that you're doing. I mean, that's one of the notes in the orchestra, so to speak, of like having your fuller stories revealed and like the depths and the complexities of each person's own story that comes out and gets more familiar. Like, I think your work is so valuable, not just as a person, but also as a South Asian American Muslim woman, to represent like the fullness of your human experience to people. It's just really empowering to break out of that like narrow image and narrow view of like what the modern Americans, modern white people kind of see Muslim women as. So so keep it up. I won't be your publisher and demand the next piece, but I will gladly await the next one for sure.
Thank you. I hope there will be one soon.
I love this one too, on that you did, the hypermasculinity. It looked like there was like kind of a couple more of them, but
I get so excited when men bring that up. Like, that makes me so happy.
Oh my god. That's the one that broke me this morning, and it's on page 33.
Thank you. Yeah, I found it. There's also a part two. Have you read that one yet?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, it's a part one better, but I'm trying to see if I can find it.
Mm-hmm. Part one just ripped me. And I want to talk about why, but first you should read it.
It actually was inspired by Nair Wahid, who's like an amazing, amazing poet. I think one of the top modern poets of our time. And I can't remember like the actual quote of her poem, but it was, I think the last line or the last verse was, I have to look it up. Like, it's so good. I can't just quote it. Yeah.
Did you realize it was similar to yours? Or like...
I think it was inspired by this.
Okay. Yeah.
Poem by Nair Wahid is, "What massacre happens to my son between him living within my skin, drinking my cells, my water, my organs, and his soft psyche turning cruel? Does he not remember he is half woman?"
That's so good.
Yeah. That one just really, really hit me because I think I was in a time in my life where I was just kind of re-understanding the idea of masculinity and men, because I had a very difficult relationship with that growing up with all the men in my life. And so it was just me trying to process and understand what that looked like. And then just, you know, getting into a relationship and getting married, all of those kind of influence that. And so the poem goes, "Give me the hardness, the excessive valor, the scared and insecure boy beneath, locked away for years, all the fragments of yourself that your father and his father and his father before him taught you to hide, to make you stone cold and acceptable to someone else's standards of what a man should be. I will shatter the hardness into a million pieces, and from the remains, nurse back to life the flowers that once secretly bloomed within, the ones you left parched and thirsty, the ones you neglected for so long. While you let them die, did you remember that half of you is made up of your tender mother?"
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Wow.
Thank you.
So good.
It was so good.
Thank you. What was your experience with that one, Bob?
Well, there's this author that I really like. His name's Reverend Matthew Fox, and he was excommunicated from the Catholic Church, which I'm realizing, on a side note, most of my heroes were kicked out of institutions. typically for good reasons. Well, that's, yeah, I have to contextualize with my face colleague here. what I mean is, like, the mystics that are, like, kind of too inclusive and too universally, like, just powerful, connective. He was actually kicked out by Cardinal Benedict, who became Pope Benedict, who looked like Emperor Palpatine. So, you know, no disrespect. Well, maybe some disrespect to Pope Benedict, former Pope Benedict. But Matthew Fox kind of wears it as a badge of honor that Cardinal Benedict kicked him out for. The list is on Wikipedia, but it's like, for talking about God as a mother, for embracing indigenous Native American spirituality alongside of his Catholicism, for, you know, for embracing homosexuality as a acceptable, you know, it's just like all of this amazing things is the reason he was excommunicated. So anyway, he wrote a book called The Sacred Masculine, and it's about, it's like 10 myths or 10 images of the sacred masculine. And I think there's a lot of material in kind of new age or like modern kind of spirituality without religion that about the sacred feminine and how important that is, and how you know, Iron Age patriarchy theology has lived on for 3,000 years, and like we really need this reawakening of the sacred feminine. And so just that interplay between like sacred masculine and sacred feminine, and your poem brought that up about, like, as far as this is what our world needs, is this sense of reflection about the relationship between those two sides of every person. And I was actually in Laredo last week talking with my in-laws about this. My wife's family is Mexican-American there, and her cousins, I was talking to her cousins, and it's a husband and a boyfriend, and they're both very gentle guys. And I was going off on machismo and how stupid to me, you know, it's just like, it's so strange that aspect of Latin American culture is so beautiful, and there's all these amazingly cool qualities of family and values and all these things, but there's this thing called machismo, and that's in that culture too. And it's so just like, I feel sorry for them, for that, those people, not everyone.
I mean, I think they have a version of that in every culture.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. We were specifically talking about it there then, but you're right. And to me, both the husband and the boyfriend that I was talking to are both gentle, contemplative guys. And it's no surprise to me that they're, you know, kind of sought after among, at least in that family, because almost like as a reaction against this, like, big truck, you know, we're in Texas, you know, it's like big truck, big belt buckle, totally in white culture also, obviously. I don't know. I just, all those images came up about the need to, you know, be reflective, and for those guys to remember their tender mothers. It's just, you put it so beautifully.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I love that so much. It reminds me of a lot of the work that I've been doing with Jennifer Miller. I mean, all of her work is really about the divine feminine, and kind of restoring balance. That last line about, remembering, you know, half of where you came from, that is such a beautiful way to just kind of put a nail in that. Cause I feel all the same things, and it's something I've been really practicing, and something that I really try and push my male counterparts, all of my male communities since I have, you know, started, embracing, the divine feminine, and, trying to, I've always been a very kind of soft and quiet guy. So I guess it maybe came a little bit naturally to me. My father was the same way, and I'm really grateful for that. I think it's great. I think it's, like, to me, one of the most important topics in our culture, across all cultures right now, is, just really, trying to restore the feminine balance in this, like, overly masculine world. And so I really appreciate that poem.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think the world would be very different if we could restore that balance, truly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Which leads us into another topic you cover, which is social action. There's no shortage. we don't have to go through every nook and cranny of the book, although I'd be happy to, but, you know, I think what, due to the relevance of contemporary culture, and, you know, hopefully that's a smooth segue from angry masculine, you know, energy to this point, which is that, you know, now we're really in, I was listening to this podcast yesterday of, it was a Sufi and a Kabbalist Jew, and they were talking about unity among Judaism and Islam. And I'm like, I want to get them on, you know, I was trying to do some Sufi research to prep for you. And, I don't know if I did or not, if that was useful, but anyway, they were talking, and neither of them were in America. And they said, and this was from like a few days ago, and they said, well, and yeah, pretty bizarre watching America implode on itself. Like, and that kind of, I didn't realize that the world is seeing that right now. That's how we're being viewed, as like, we have the most COVID cases. We have historical, racial injustice momentum here. You know, we are certainly at odds. And so I think, I guess the segue is that, you know, all of this material, you know, to me empowers the social action and, you know, kind of connectivity and harmony between people in that, action for equality and in that action for justice. And, you've been very active recently on social, which I really enjoyed. And I know you've been going to, several marches, and, talked about the Dallas Muslim community and their relationship to BLM, which I found very interesting and very noble of you to criticize certain aspects of. And so, jump in however you like to talk about social action and spirituality.
Yeah. So it's funny because I can remember myself being like the 12 or 13 year old girl that was just like, I don't like politics. It's really boring. whatever.
Yeah.
And then I grew up and was like, this is a key aspect of our faith, this political and social action. And I very much tie any kind of, and I don't really consider myself an activist. I don't think I've earned that title yet. But it's work that I'm interested in, and I try to immerse myself in as much as possible. And because I think it is so prophetic to be able to do that, because all the prophets and all the holy people of all time have always been considered radical. And they were preaching not just a message of, you know, one God or whatever it is that we believe our prophets preach, but they were preaching a message of kindness and unity and equality and equity and, you know, destroying the patriarchy. Like, all of these things that we're still fighting right now are things that they all talked about in some way or the other. And I think when people message down to, we worship a white Jesus and that's what Jesus told us to do, it's just like, well, what about all the other things Jesus preached? Because I certainly don't think he'd be okay with, you know, police killing black people, and that's not what he was about or what Christianity was about. Right. And so everything to me that comes down to activism or social justice is about upholding that end of our faith. And I think in this time that we're in the time that I am in, and the journey that I'm on with my faith, I think that's like what's really been brought out. And I think several years ago, it was really about spirituality. And while I would love to get back into that, I think right now, like, my expression of my faith is coming out in just like the work I'm wanting to do and trying to do. And that's just building or working to build on whatever small level that we can, building a just world for all of us to live in. And it's interesting because as people of faith, like, we know and we believe that the world is not meant to be perfect and that there's an afterlife that's better and that there's things that you are going to give up in this world that you get in the next. But one of those things you don't give up is wanting for your neighbor or your brother what you want for yourself. And that's something that activism is about. It's not just about you living in your comfortable life on your prayer mat every night, like praying the God to save you. It's also about feeding the hungry and feeding the poor and standing up for justice and standing up against injustice. And it's just, it's one of those things that to me has become so crystal clear, that this is an essential part of our faith, that I just sometimes find myself so surprised that people don't seem to see it that way or understand it that way, because there are so many verses and like hadith and like quotes of the prophet that like we'll say in our Friday sermons and in our halakhas and like in all these little like gatherings we'll have to talk about faith, and again across all faith communities, not just the Muslim one, like about, you know, there's one in particular that's really powerful, is that if you see an injustice, you change it with your hand. If you can't change it with your hand, you change it with your tongue. And if you can't change it with your tongue, you feel bad about it in your heart. And that is the lowest level of faith. So I'm like, are we all like just feeling bad about it all the time? And you know, some of us aren't even feeling bad about it because it's not even our problem.
We're not even at the lowest.
And so it just makes me wonder, like, where are all of us then, when it comes to standing up for each other in like the most powerfully possible.
What you do for the least of these is in the Bible. What you do for the least of these is what you do for me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how I've kind of started to conflate like my faith with like social justice work, to the point where like one of the poems I was mentioning earlier that I wrote, that I was like, oh, this is a really good one. I didn't think I could top my last one, was about how I made the argument prophets were all activists, and activists is like a very like negative connotation to people who aren't. It's just like, ew, like gross, like we're educators, not activists. Like I've seen that before. And I was just like, that's stupid. Not even gonna get that stupid. Because activism looks different on all different fronts. And you can be an activist in your education. You can be an activist and like, you know, using your body as a shield. You can be an activist by filling up the jails because like that's what you can do right now. I mean, there's so many ways to do that. And there's so many ways to fight for justice. Like signing petitions, making phone calls, whatever it is that you want to do or can do or have the capacity to do, all of it is important and should never be discounted. And so I made the argument that all the prophets were activists and that we should stop conflating one with the other, and that our religions, all religions, call for that, and how the hypocrisy of all of us, where we can, you know, applaud Moses for standing up to the Pharaoh, but like, what is the line? We'll applaud Moses for standing up to the Pharaoh, but we, you know, we shy away at the idea of actually standing up to or for anybody else. Let me find it, because I think it's an incredible one. Or like there's a story, I don't know if this is a story in any other religious text, but there's a story of Abraham, like Prophet Abraham, smashing all the idols, but then like leaving the biggest one and being like, oh, I didn't do it, he did it. And like, it's like a thing like we all love and joke about, but it's just like, oh, but civil disobedience is just like a little too radical for us. Like we can't do that. Or like cheering on Moses for facing off with the Pharaoh, who's like the most powerful evil being of that time and probably of all time. But at the same time, we'll be like, we're just going to dialogue with all our you know, oppressors and just think that we can like kindly change their minds. And it's just like, no, like there's a time and a place for that. And imagine Moses having dinner with the Pharaoh, like that's laughable. or something like Jesus, like, you know, there's like this thing of like, Jesus doesn't consider his work charity or post it to social media, or he didn't step outside his own comfortable bubble. Like he was part of the community that he wanted to help create change in, and he was considered radical.
Yeah.
And then Prophet Muhammad, like, you know, wrote letters to kings and held secret meetings and taught his people how to pray behind closed doors, escaped assassins, resisted a boycott, built an army, was taught by God to fight, stopped female children from being buried alive, conquered a whole city bloodlessly. And it's just like, they were all activists. Like, this is literally like their revolutionary. But how you again view what they're preaching, like, is it just about preaching one God, which is like, yes, that's a big part of the message, but it's also just about preaching like an entire uprooting of society and changing it to be better and to be kinder, and to look out for your neighbors and to help the helpless and help the poor. And it's like, none of these ideas are awful or mean, or I mean, unless you're extremely self-centered, it's asking you to give up a part of yourself, but so someone else can have a little bit more. So yeah, I think that that's kind of where my relationship is with faith right now, is it's very much about like seeking justice and being a voice for justice, even if I can't do it all the time, or I'm not always in a place to do so. Like, I think I've taken a break from like protests since I moved, because I'm just trying to build furniture with my husband and unpack clothes and figure out like where I can be settled and stable. But it's always, I think, going to be in the back of my mind and something I will really want to seek out as much as I can.
Well said. Those figures didn't exist in a vacuum. They were human beings that were passionate, and they had human experiences that were reflected in their actions. They're, you know, they weren't just empty proselytizers. Their work wouldn't remain for the centuries if it was hollowed out, you know, wooden, empty platitudes. They were so impactful because it was such a holistic sense of their identity that they lived it and were it. And yeah, that's really a great point, and I look forward to the rest of that piece whenever it was. That a unreleased that was a I've new mix it, unmixed.
It's a spoken word piece, actually. I've performed it a couple of times in public, but like it'll definitely be in the next book whenever that comes out, and be in the next 10 years.
2030, you heard it here. Awesome. Well, I have one final piece here. We just hit 12, which is our kind of winding down moment. I don't know if you guys, did y'all want to bring up anything else? Or
I got my favorite question. One read, so I'm happy.
Perfect. Wonderful.
No, yeah, I'm good. I'm just really enjoying, listening and hearing Sarah's perspective, and just really grateful to be here and talking.
Beautiful. Yeah, this is the last, really, we kind of wanted to establish a theme of most podcasts and most of these kinds of shows have like a one final question that's similar. So maybe it's uncool to directly say that, but this is ours.
It's too late, Bob. You said it.
It's out there that we're mirroring this formula. The last question for us is like favorite books, favorite thinkers, like obscure to mainstream. Like who basically the question is like, who is someone that you wish more people knew about or read about?
That's a good question.
And you approve have no time of our to think formula. Of your answer.
Oh, I definitely. I think. Like quite obviously like the Prophet Muhammad, I think he was like named as one of the greatest men of all time, but I think again on a different level, just continuing on what we just mentioned, like I really wish people would understand him to be a whole person and someone who was very human. Like I read, you know, a story about him in like one of his biographies about how he experienced heartbreak as a teenager, and that like changed everything about the way I viewed him, like everything. Because I think the way prophets and religion is taught to us is like they're just stories. And even though like we know they're people, we say we must love them, et cetera, like there's not like this like there's this disconnect between what we know and what we feel. And this is the moment where I was like, wow, like he had his heart broken. Like, how many of us have been through that and like struggled through that and suffered through that? And like, can we imagine like our prophet going through that? And so it's like, I wish people would understand him as a whole person. I'm still trying to learn to understand him as a whole person. Like, I by no means claim to understand a whole lot about him, but I think I'm starting to unlock that human element of him that I think many of us don't really quite get. And that activist element of him where he was radical in the kindest, most gentle way possible. And that's something I think we all need to learn is like that balance. Because when we're radical, we're very radical, or we're very outspoken, but we don't do it with that gentleness and humility that he did. But by all means, he was an activist and he was radical and he was a revolutionary. And I wish people saw him as that and understood him as that. As for favorite books, I actually have two favorite books that I've like secured on my bookshelf these last few years. And one is The New Jim Crow. I think that's one I read a couple years ago, and it changed my life for and I read it, I think it was a project in one of our classes for social work school.
We talked about her, Michelle Alexander.
Yeah. And I think there were three books we were supposed to read, and I got placed in a different group, so I didn't get to read it immediately. But I read it a couple months later, and I was just blown away, because it's like, these are things we kind of know, but to read how someone breaks it down so eloquently and just basically spits out the facts and is like, this is, slavery never really ended. And you're just like, whoa. And even though like you kind of know, or like you might be somewhat conscious or aware of it, like you don't realize just how big the problem is and how much it's been disguised into something else. So that's a really important book for me. I think also The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein is one I recently finished. And that might have been the most traumatizing book I've ever read in my life ever. It took me 2 months to read, but it's, I don't know if y'all are familiar with it, but she writes a lot about capitalism and disaster capitalism and economics. And I believe she's a journalist, but just one of the best writers like I've ever encountered. And that's like the only book of hers I've really ever read. But basically broke down like US imperialism in its modern time and how it's, what it's looked like, why other countries hate America so much. And the way that the U.S. has conquered in a different way so many different countries around the world and subjected it to the free market thinking and capitalism and, you know, corporatism really is like the term that she uses. So even though like I'm not very well versed on economics or politics as much as I'd like to be, like that book is something I think should be a required reading for everybody, because it's like a modern day history of like, this is what we're really living in. And this is why you see all the billionaires of the world getting richer off of COVID-19 is exactly because of this model, is because this is working from back then, how it is now and how it's been developed to work now. And so it was just really, really eye-opening. Yeah.
We talk a lot about late stage capitalism and the problems that it's just morphed into this, you know, like all consuming, inhuman, profit over people monster. And
And like when I read like in scripture, like the passages about like people who seek the world so like and hold on to it so dearly, like now I'm starting to understand what that really means. It's just like, what do you get by being the world's first trillionaire, Jeff Bezos? Like, I don't understand. Like the world is falling apart and you're like, I'm gonna be the world's first trillionaire. Like, for what? Like, why? Could end world poverty like 10 times over and be known better for that, but like you don't. And it's just this greed that like entrenches us, or you know, that, and I'm not in that position, so I don't know. I wonder what goes through their mind or what they're really trying to accomplish. But it's that like desperation to hold on to everything in the world that like I'm starting to really be like, oh, that's what that means.
Totally.
And how much more there is beyond that. Yeah,
it's completely
serious, the opposite of mystic happening there.
Yeah, I don't know. And then other books, I think I'd always recommend Harry Potter over anything, absolutely, in the whole world. Even though I read them like every couple of years, and I think I read it again after the 2016 elections or something like that. And it was powerful and helpful, and I think helped me understand again why I want to be more entrenched in social justice work, because Harry Potter is a book about racism and social justice. Like, you just have to read that.
Yeah.
And so I think balancing some of like the really, really heavy stuff with like Harry Potter is really helpful.
Great point. You can't. The new Jim Crow and the shock doctrine are useful education, but yeah, temper
and,
them
and then
with...
pop over to Hogwarts after that for, right. to relax and learn about magic and racism.
Absolutely, pure blooded, whatever.
Necessary yeah. balance.
Mugglists.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, totally all about racism.
Those are great. Yeah. Those are great, Rex. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, thank you for joining us. This has been so great, and you know, come back again someday.
I hope
have
you guys
to be a one and done. Yeah, you're doing amazing work. Maybe we'll get an update on FACE in the future.
I hope so. Yeah, we've been working on some stuff for a really long time, so we're hoping to release all of it soon. So hopefully you'll see that when it comes.
Well, and hopefully, I mean, we want to raise awareness of the great work that you guys are doing. So hopefully we do that. And yeah, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Good to see everyone.
Nice to meet y'all.
Thanks, Sarah.
Nice to meet you,
Sarah. Bye.
Take care. Bye. All right.